Jim Reston, I want to ask you about a book that has created a bit of a stir, in which you're going to posit that Lee Harvey Oswald did not intend to kill President Kennedy, but was in fact trying to kill John Connally. So how did you get into that story, and how did you come to that remarkable conclusion?
I was between books in 1985, and the publisher of Harper & Row approached me and asked me to do a biography of Jesse Helms, knowing of my North Carolina roots. I don't know whether he knew of my left-leaning proclivities in asking me to do this or not, but at any rate, I took a big gulp and said I would do this. I found out 2 or 3 months later that there was a book on Jesse Helms that was about to be published, and so I called him up and said, you know, we're going to have to find something different to do. Very shortly thereafter, John Connally, great confidant of LBJ for all those many years, present in the car as governor of Texas in Dallas on November 22nd and wounded. Later goes on the cabinet of Richard Nixon and at the end runs for president in 1980 and doesn't go anywhere and goes back to Texas to become Texas rich. Then falls flat on his face and goes bankrupt and owes $50 million. Well, that happened when we were looking for a replacement subject. So I called up the publisher and said, I'll do that. And so I threw myself into the Connally story. As you move through the narrative of that life, you center on the Dallas assassination. And this is one of the glories of being a writer, that when you take a book on, there are surprises that come your way. And I was very, very surprised and riveted to learn that there was really a relationship between Lee Harvey Oswald and John Connally that went back 2 years before the Dallas assassination. And the relationship had to do with a military discharge for Lee Harvey Oswald, where he had been in the Marine Corps and had been discharged honorably. And it was the only thing that this wretched little man had ever done of value in his life, was to get through the Marine Corps and be honorably discharged. Well, he was this scatterbrain character with a ninth grade education. And he grandly decided afterwards that after his military career that he was going to defect and go to the Soviet Union.
Oswald
did. So he went to the Soviet Union and spent a year and a half, and after a year and a half decided it really wasn't cracked up to be what he thought it was going to be and wanted to go home. And at that point, he learned that his discharge, this valued thing in his resume, had been summarily changed from honorable to dishonorable. And the Navy had done this, Navy being over the Marine Corps, as a result of his attempt to defect to the Soviet Union. So he writes a letter to the Secretary of the Navy, who he hears is from Texas, and indeed from Fort Worth, where he is from, this plaintive letter about this outrage of this summary change in his discharge. And he was right. There was no proper hearing for this. So he had a case. So he writes to John Connally, who is then the Secretary of the Navy. And just about a year later, when really he's about to get on the train to go back to America from the Soviet Union, he gets a response from John Connally, which is a classic bureaucratic brush off. I'm no longer Secretary of the Navy. Here's my successor's name. Sincerely yours. And it comes to Oswald in Russia in an envelope that says, John Connally for governor of Texas, a promotional thing, and there's a headshot of Connally in the midst of a Texas star. Well, he knows, Oswald does, that when he comes back to the United States, he's going to have a terrible time finding work if his discharge is changed. And indeed, that happens. Because in any interview, the only thing he's got to say for himself is that he was discharged from the Marine Corps. And of course, they ask immediately, were you honorably discharged? And it causes him great anxiety. It's my theory that he became kind of obsessed with Connally as the one who had refused to address his discharge, and he takes a great aversion to Connally. I think it moves into a kind of rage, And what I was able to discover in researching that Connolly book was that in the background testimony for the Warren Commission that was supposed to look into the Kennedy assassination, Oswald's wife, Marina, testified 3 times that Oswald was going after Connolly and not after Kennedy. The members of the white Russian diaspora in Dallas, who knew Oswald, spoke of his ire and hate of Connolly. And Marina Oswald, when she was re-interviewed in 1977, stood by the testimony that he was going after Connolly. You put that in parallel to to Oswald's attitude towards Kennedy, which was one of total admiration. So there is no emotional reason for Lee Harvey Oswald to have picked up that rifle and gone after Kennedy. So I think this insight is what I believe it is in relation to Oswald's motive comes partly because I was a novelist, or am a novelist, and, you know, I'm interested in what drives people. What, you know, you can object to somebody's politics, but what makes you go beyond an objection and be so hateful that you want to pick up a rifle and kill somebody? That's a big, big step, and it's emotional. It's not intellectual. So the last thing to say is that the Warren Commission just simply said that his motive was that he was a Marxist and he had a few grandiose ideas. But there are lots of Marxists out there that don't pick up weapons and go out to kill people.
The notion that somehow the president of the United States could be killed by accident, there's something asymmetric about that, that it doesn't seem to match up with the kind of explanation that we would like. And this then leads us to whether you believe this will be received as one more conspiracy theory, or do you believe that your case is made sufficiently that this is likely to change the dialogue? Because to my knowledge, this has not been posited before, has it?
Yes, it has. I mean, I suggested it in my Connolly biography and on the 25th anniversary. And here we're coming up to the 50th, where there's going to be wall-to-wall focus on JFK. I think you're absolutely right. This is going to be very hard to get accepted, because anybody in America wants to believe if so horrendous a crime as the assassination of a president comes along, there has to be a motive of the killer as grand as the crime. So we want to believe that he was a Marxist, he had grandiose notions, or we want to believe that there was some conspiracy where a criminal organization or a foreign country hired this guy as an assassin to do it. I think that's ridiculous.
Well, he had a rifle with a scope on it. Was he that bad a shot?
He had a rifle that was a mail order rifle with the lowest possible ammunition quality. And The Day of the Jackal is a movie about an attempted assassination on Charles de Gaulle. The Jackal in that movie is a professional killer who is hired by, you know, a right-wing organization in France. The Cuban government, if they set out to kill the president of the United States, is not going to hire a wretched little man with a ninth grade education who is totally scattered in his mind. Nor if a mafia group wants to kill the president are they going to hire some little creep like Lee Harvey Oswald. They're going to get a real professional with the best possible rifle and the best possible ammunition and the best possible way to kill him. So this book of mine is totally anti-conspiracy, even though the History Channel has had a poll that says 85% of the American people now believe there was a conspiracy, and there's no evidence of it whatsoever.
How close was Connolly to Kennedy in the car, logistically, geometrically? What's the probability that he could miss at that close a range?
Once you get into the third floor of the book depository, he has 2 possibilities. One is to fire the shot as the car is coming towards the book depository, and the other is to fire when it's gone past the book depository. There is actually a memo in the Warren Commission documents about whether Connally was truly the target, and they discard this theory by saying if that was the case, maybe Oswald really would have shot at him when they were coming toward him. Well, I would say, as a logical matter, if you were going to try to kill somebody, that you want to have the best opportunity to escape that you can. So you've got a better opportunity to escape if you shoot when they're going away and then get away rather than when they're coming towards you. That's point number one. Point number two is that as that car comes past the book depository, there's a tree there. And so the car has to go beyond the tree for Oswald to have a shot. And by that time, he's looking at a limousine where John Connally is sitting immediately in front of the president. And so, I mean, if truly he wanted to distinguish between shooting Connally or shooting the president, it'd be a very, very difficult thing to do. So I've seen those perspectives, and of course, that's been reconstructed many times in various forums. So I don't think it's really that important that the fact that he killed the president and didn't kill Connally means that he was out to get the president instead of Connally. As a point, and a point of fact, he almost did kill Connally with the first shot that went through Kennedy's neck and went into Connally's back, missed his vital organs by an inch, went through his body and hit his leg through his wrist and ended up hitting his leg. So it was an incredible shot, the first one. But that didn't kill the president. And if that had been the only shot passing through the neck, the president would have survived.
And you believe that the president's corset kept him erect and put him between the shooter and Connally, who by then was slumped over.
Right. This is something that President Kennedy had attempted to keep from the public all his public life about his terrible back problems and his medical problems generally. And he wanted to present himself as an erect, military, handsome figure. But he had this terrible back problem, several terrible operations on it. And the remedy for that in 1963 was to wear this corset, which had shoelaces and it had straps on it. And the Kennedy's valet would strap the president into this corset before he would go into the public. On that day, in addition to that corset, he had an ACE bandage, which was wrapped around the corset itself, so it further almost mummified him where his lower torso could not move. So if you look at the Zapruder film after that first shot through the neck, there are 5 full seconds in which the president remains erect in that car while the rest of them, Connally in particular, are writhing in pain and figures in motion. And so with the second shot that blows his head off, he's just the sole stationary target there for the second shot.
And the book is called?
The Accidental Victim.
James Reston, Jr., thanks for being with us.
Delighted.